From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Public trust and police accountability. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Intensive policing gets credit for reducing crime. It also gets the blame for excessive force on the streets of American cities. Deadly incidents involving black suspects have sparked massive protests in Missouri, Ohio, South Carolina, and New York City. In Baltimore, when officers were accused of crimes, 65% of Americans approved. There and elsewhere, there are moves for reform opposed by local police unions. Do they still have political clout? Or is the climate finally right for civilian oversight? Today's talking point, Britain's national election campaign is mercifully brief, but tomorrow's election could be historic. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Deadly incidents involving police have sparked major protests in several American cities. Local police unions may no longer be able to resist reforms. Is civilian oversight the answer? What should it look like? Today's talking point, British voters head to the polls tomorrow for an election that could alter decades of two-party rule. We'll hear what it could mean for the European Union and for American interests. First, this news update, American companies are dominating the way Europeans use online services, and the European Union has already brought antitrust charges against Google. Today, it broadened its investigation to include Apple, Amazon, and other U.S. giants of e-commerce. Mark Scott reports for the New York Times. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon, Warren.
Is the concern in Europe that their companies are behind the curve?
Exactly. The European politicians would say that this is not an anti-U.S. Attempt, but when you look at the size of the U.S. tech giants compared to their European counterparts, it's a fact that the U.S. companies like Google, Amazon, and Apple just are so much more bigger than their European counterparts.
So what is the ultimate objective? Are they trying to get rules for the entire 28-nation EU?
Exactly. So the plan is that at the moment, each national government has their own rules and regulations, which makes it very difficult for, say, a German company to sell to a Portuguese person based in Lisbon, for example. And so what they're trying to do is create some laws that span the whole continent. So if I'm a retailer selling online or I'm a person looking to buy something online, I can access all of Europe, not just my national market.
So I understand countries like France and Germany, for example, want more regulation, but other countries don't?
Exactly. So in Europe, there is a divide between certain governments about what should and should not be regulated online. There are certain governments, particularly France and Germany, as you mentioned, that would like to, say, have more regulation and control over both digital services as well as how individuals access those services, where others in London, in Britain, where I'm based, they look for something that might be more hands-off.
So what's the difference? Why do different companies have different ideas about this?
Different countries. Basically, it comes down to legacy issues as well as how different governments have approached the online world. Some would prefer to have it more regulated. Others would prefer to be hands-off.
So we got countries and we got companies. What about the American companies and what are they saying about this, Google and Amazon and Apple?
Well, their view is that they have done nothing wrong and that they are competing just along the same lines as their European counterparts. And they would view, and they've been telling me today, that they see what they're doing is benefiting the European consumer, not aggravating the situation by providing services that, in the end, European consumers want.
Should the American companies be concerned? Are they going to be limited in ways that are going to make it more difficult for them to do business?
They could be. I think what needs to be taken into consideration is that this antitrust inquiry is at a very early stage. And as you mentioned, the Google antitrust case is now in its fifth year. So no matter what happens, this is not going to be coming to a close overnight. And as we all know, that the internet and online services change pretty quickly. So what happens now may not be the same in 5 years' time.
So if there are antitrust charges against Google, who is it supposed to be competing against, and where's the lack of competition?
So at the moment, Google has roughly a 90% market share in online search here in Europe. In contrast, they have about a 67% market share in the U.S., so they are pretty significantly bigger over here. And they compete against certain European search engines. There is obviously Microsoft Bing's product as well, but the antitrust investigation is specifically looking at things like when you search for travel sites or when you search for online purchases, there is a view that the European policymakers believe that potentially Google has overstepped the mark on those and in those areas.
And some of the issues they're looking at are tax issues, I take it.
Yeah, so there are multiple investigations going on in Europe right now. A separate and not connected investigation is looking at some of the tax practices of certain U.S. tech companies, including Amazon and Apple. These, again, are still under works. There is no one is saying that these companies have done anything wrong yet, but European policymakers are definitely taking a close look at how and what taxes they pay over here.
What kind of money is involved?
Well, again, it's difficult to tell right now, but we're talking potentially hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, depending on how the investigation goes.
And when you have 28 countries in Europe, they all have to agree on things, as I understand it. How long is it going to take them to work this out?
Well, I suppose it's how long is a piece of string. This could take years, and no one is expecting a resolution to any of this by the end of the year. But I think the idea is that Europe is trying to created, in their words, a more level playing field for European companies and consumers against U.S. tech companies. And so this could go on for years.
All right. Mark Scott, European tech correspondent for The New York Times, talking to us from London. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, public trust and police accountability on To The Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on only back with To The Point. Six Baltimore police officers have been charged with crimes, including manslaughter in the death of the young black suspect, Freddie Gray. The Justice Department is investigating that case. Today, Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake asked for more.
We have to get it right. Failure is not an option. In order to achieve the kind of sustainable and significant reform that we want to see, that I want to see, that the citizens want to see in Baltimore, I am requesting the Department of Justice conduct a federal pattern or practice investigation into the Baltimore City Police Department.
Wesley Lowry covers law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've covered Ferguson. You've covered the incidents in South Carolina and New York. Is she asking for an investigation like the one that took place in Ferguson, Missouri?
Yes, exactly what she's asking for is an investigation much like the one that happened in Ferguson, where they look not only at a specific incident, rather they open the books and look at everything that the police department has done. How are its traffic stops conducted? When is force being used? A comprehensive look. Again, in part because so many people who are showing up to these protests are saying that, no, this isn't about Freddie Gray. It's about me getting arrested last week or about last month when this happened or last year when this happened. So she's requesting a much larger probe.
How are the police reacting to this?
I haven't seen a direct response yet from the police officers themselves. I would expect the police unions to probably not welcome with open arms this type of investigation, as we saw in some of these other cities, in Ferguson, for example, and other places where they've done these types of in-depth probes. There's some resistance sometimes from the police departments themselves. But I do think that, like any police department that goes through this, we're probably going to hear initially from the police unions and from the department itself that, no, we don't think we have this deep of a problem, but then eventually them cooperating with the investigators.
The police commissioner was not with her when she made this call for a greater investigation. Does that imply that he would prefer that it not happen?
Not necessarily. However, there certainly could be some politics there. The one thing that's been interesting in Baltimore has been the police commissioner has been relatively forthcoming in terms of criticizing his own department. In 2013, the police commissioner put out a 140-page strategic plan that said, largely, we need to improve relationships in our communities. We need to continue cutting down on some issues within the department itself. In this case, he came out even before the charges were announced, and he said that, at the very least, his officers had not followed department policy. And in fact, just yesterday, he even said that, yes, our officers made some mistakes here. That is much different in terms of tone and in terms of taking responsibility than we've seen some of the other police chiefs and commissioners in some of the other cities that have had similar cases that have gone national.
Let's hear a bit of what Commissioner Anthony Batts had to say when he was talking to CNN.
By every metric that you measure a police department on, we've hit a home run, and we're going in the right direction. There is a lack of trust within this community, period, bottom line, and that's going to take healing. That's going to take us acknowledging as a police department, not just here in Baltimore, but law enforcement as a whole, that we've been part of the problem.
Let me introduce Chuck Canterbury. He is president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. He's been reelected to that job as president many times. Chuck Canterbury, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What about those words that we just heard from the commissioner in Baltimore, that law enforcement as a whole has been part of the problem?
I'm glad that the police commissioner and President Obama just this week recognized what we testified to at the 21st Century Policing Committee. We understand that there are a number of communities in the United States that have distrust of law enforcement. And finally, the president actually recognized what we've been saying for years, is that in impoverished communities with abject poverty, law enforcement is the only arm of government that they ever see. And if there is not a holistic approach to helping these communities with the high percentage of unemployment, the high high school dropout rate, the high percentage of single parent homes and abject poverty, law enforcement alone cannot take that mission on and make things better in those communities. And when your number one or number two employment is criminality such as drug dealing, we're not going to be welcome in those neighborhoods. And there's going to be instant resentment for law enforcement being there. And we've been saying that since the early 90s, and we're very pleased to see commissioners and the President of the United States finally agreeing with us that law enforcement's not the whole, the only way to solve that. With that said, we also agree as a union that there needs to be greater community involvement with the police unions and with management, but it needs to be a collaborative. It doesn't need to be individually, because if we do that, we'll be many parts working in different directions.
Let me go back to Wesley Lowery with the Washington Post. Again, you've been in Ferguson, you were in South Carolina, you were in the other Cleveland, I believe, and other places where there have been incidents of enormous community reaction, negative reaction to deadly incidents. Are the police responding in those places in the way we just heard Chuck Canterbury respond, in the way we heard the police commissioner in Baltimore?
Well, I think, and this is a question a lot of people are asking, and I think that Baltimore is a great example of it, a place that in many ways has changed so many of its policies from the early 2000s and from the 90s, that really has attempted to reemphasize some levels of community policing, has undergone some very thorough reviews in some cases and some allegations of brutality or excessive force. So a police department that, by all measures, really has been trying to do the work. But The problem is, you once a relationship is severed, a relationship is severed, and it takes real time to rebuild that on part of the police as well as on part of the community. And that's what we're seeing even in Baltimore, a city that by most measures is really trying and putting in a lot of good faith efforts right now. It just seemed that their trust deficit was too deep to prevent the type of outrage that happened once the Freddie Gray situation occurred.
So, Chuck Canterbury, back to you. Is it incumbent then on the police to try to make some sort of steps itself, themselves, toward creating more trust? Obviously, it's going to take a long time to deal with the kinds of broader issues that you talked about, including poverty.
Well, absolutely. And I think the collaborative agreement in Cincinnati after the early 2000 riots has proven that collaborative efforts that involve all the moving parts do tend to increase the trust level, not just with law enforcement, but government in general. I mean, if you go into those neighborhoods in West Baltimore or in the more impoverished neighborhoods around Washington, D.C., it's a distrust of government in general, not just law enforcement. We just happen to be the most visible part.
Haven't, though, police unions in various places around the country been very resistant to reforms?
No, that's absolutely ridiculous. We're opposed to reforms that take away due process rights for law enforcement. We're opposed to reforms that force at-will employment on our members. But police departments and police unions in general and the FOP for over 100 years have been bringing staffing level training, less than lethal techniques, community relations, the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder in law enforcement, workers' compensation issues. We've been bringing those forward to the cities to show cities and counties to show that these are all issues that have to be addressed. You know, there's 100,000 less police officers in the United States today than there was in 1998. With staffing levels going down that drastically, our ability to perform anything other than reactive law enforcement is greatly reduced.
Again, Wesley Lowery, back to you. Are you hearing this kind of argument from the people in charge of the police in the various cities that you've covered where there have been these massive demonstrations?
No, of course. That's a point that police chiefs and line officers and high-ranking officers are making across the country. This idea that, especially if you look at, one, some of the federal funding that went away at the end of the 1990s and the early 2000s, the recession that then hit so many cities across the country in the early 2000s. And we have to remember, police departments rely on tax dollars very largely for their funding, especially in a city like Baltimore or Cleveland or Detroit, where the cities have had large financial problems. Police have had to deal with cuts. And so there are fewer officers on the streets, certainly. And when you look at the policing strategies that many police departments say they would prefer to employ, which is more officers out on foot, out of their cars, patrolling, in athletic leagues with kids, that takes more officers, and that means it takes more money. And so what we've seen in a combination of things, because of fewer federal grants available to some of these departments, as well as some of the budgetary restraints of the cities that fund these departments, a lot of departments have had to cut back. And so the point of there being fewer officers on the street is one that a lot of police officials are making.
Police behavior or misbehavior, accusations of abuse have been a problem for a long time in many cities, including Los Angeles, going, of course, back to the Rodney King incident, which led to rioting in this city and before that as well, and also with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Michael Giannacco is a former federal prosecutor. He focuses on misconduct by police and on police prosecutions and on oversight as well. Has done so for the last 15 years. Michael Giannacco, welcome to you.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be with you again.
What are some of the formulas for oversight, if that's what we're talking about here, that have been applied not just here in Los Angeles, but elsewhere?
Well, there's about as many different kinds of oversight as there are police agencies. And in fact, most of the police agencies in this country still have no form of civilian oversight over them. That being said, the trend is towards increased involvement by the citizens and by civilians in taking a look and at least having a seat at the table with regard to the mechanisms and the way in which policing is occurring in their communities.
Why is it that many communities don't have oversight? I think a lot of people assume they do.
Most communities do not have oversight because we live in a country in which virtually every city can and does have their own police. And I think that for the most case, there hasn't been an acceptance by executives, and in some cases, just not a cry for oversight. That cry, I think, is getting louder in more recent years.
Have police unions around the country tried to resist police civilian oversight?
I think police unions have tended to be concerned about having an involvement of civilians involved in the oversight of the conduct of their officers. Some of it is contractual. Some of it is the fact that they have engaged in contracts in order to perform their public responsibilities. And the contract says that this is the way things are going to be done. And when you have oversight getting involved, particularly vibrant oversight, you're going to have to change that contract. And so I think in part, the unions resist that because they believe they've negotiated these contracts in good faith and don't want to change the status quo.
Chuck Canterbury, back to you, the president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. To what extent do you think police might be willing, given what's been happening over the past few weeks and months, to modify their behavior? You said you were glad that there were calls for more civilian involvement.
We are, and the type of civilian involvement we are is interaction with law enforcement, learning the responsibility of law enforcement. But to say that there's no civilian overview in most of the departments in the country is just not an accurate statement. First of all, civilian oversight, just eight different things that police officers are actually nine, internal affairs investigations, then we have police management that have oversight, prosecutorial review, then judicial review from the court themselves, then there's the grand jury process, then there are police certification post standards that are looked at, then we all work for elected civilian employers, and then we have DOJ as well as civil suits. So to say that there's no civilian oversight is a stretch. All of those issues, even though the internal affairs investigations and police management oversight would probably not fit the civilian oversight, every one of the other examples I did quote are strictly civilian.
Okay, let me go back to Michael Giannacco. How do you respond to that?
Well, obviously there are systems in place, the judicial system, the prosecutors, et cetera, that do provide some level of review. The problem is that it is not civilian oversight in its purest form. And folks in some communities and in some jurisdictions do not believe what is going on is really objective oversight. And the fact of the matter is, for example, on the prosecution side, many are concerned that because prosecutors work so closely and need the police to do their investigative work, that it's very difficult for them to set apart that relationship in order to objectively evaluate police allegations of misconduct.
So what would you call the purest form of civilian oversight? You use that phrase.
Well, by purest, I'm talking about individuals who have no connection with the current criminal justice system, either members of the community or individuals who are independent of the police department and any of the other current systems.
Okay.
Who have an objective perspective and can weigh in from that objective perspective.
All right. Excuse me. I'm going to interrupt you because we need to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation. We'll hear from Chuck Canterbury on the issue of civilians that have no connection with the police department whatsoever. On our talking point later on, Britain's national election campaign is mercifully brief, but tomorrow's election could be historic. We'll find out why. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
Mormon Olney back with To The Point, talking today about incidents of police abuse, or what appear to be police abuse incidents around the country, and whether there is, in fact, a need for greater civilian oversight. Ed McGuire is a professor of criminology at American University in Washington. He's co-author of Implementing Community Policing, Lessons from 12 Agencies. He's working on a guidebook for police called Policing Protests, Lessons from the Occupy Movement and Beyond. Professor McGuire, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We just ended a conversation, which will continue as we go along, between Chuck Canterbury, the president of the National Fraternal Order of Police, and Michael Giannacco, a former prosecutor who focuses on police misconduct in the Los Angeles area, about civilian oversight. How important is it, and does it need to be, by police, by people who, as Michael Giannacco referred to them, in their purest form, don't have any connection, such as prosecutors do, with the police departments themselves?
Well, it's a difficult question. You know, unions often raise, I think, a pretty important issue, which is that certain forms of civilian oversight involve people who don't really understand what the police do, what the real dangers are that they face, and just what it's like to do that very difficult job. At the same time, insiders, when they're carrying out investigations of alleged police misconduct, sometimes give the benefit of the doubt to their fellow officers. And so there needs to be a happy medium here, where we develop a civilian oversight procedure that has the requisite skill and experience to be able to investigate these matters.
How often is it that, rather than just giving other officers the benefit of the doubt, there are real efforts at a cover-up and denial of what's going on, as is claimed by a lot of the people that have been taken to the streets in various cities around the country?
Well, nobody knows. There aren't good numbers on these matters, and it would be very difficult to measure. We know it happens. At the same time, there are many, many very, very dedicated, very neutral, sort of very professional internal affairs investigators who take these things very seriously. And so how often this kind of cover-up or just kind of shallow investigations happen, we simply don't know.
Should we know? Should there be an effort to find out?
Yeah, although it would be very difficult to measure, right? I mean, these are very complicated matters. But I do think it is important for us to try to put in place the forms of civilian oversight that involve legitimate investigations. Unfortunately, what happens is a lot of civilian oversight bodies, when they're created, are essentially toothless. In other words, they have the power to do investigations. Sometimes they lack the power to be able to subpoena witnesses. Sometimes their recommendations are only advisory and end up getting ignored. And so the idea is to put in place legitimate civilian oversight bodies that can actually carry out investigations and not be toothless.
So, Michael Giannacco, back to you. You've been involved in these kinds of issues. Beyond what we just heard from Ed McGuire, what does it mean to not be toothless? And how far can you expect the police to go in accepting oversight that does have teeth?
Yeah, Professor McGuire makes very good points. You know, one thing that is critical in order to not be toothless is to have access to materials, access to people, and access to the executives making the decisions. That's one thing. The second thing is to be able to review those materials and have a meaningful voice with regard to outcomes. I'm not suggesting that it necessarily is so that the civilian overseer gets to dictate the result, but should have a role to play as far as participating in the decision-making process. I think that's critical, and I think one of the reasons that oversight has not caught on as much as it has is because overseers end up being more frustrated than successful with regard to some of these issues.
Let me go back to Chuck Canterbury, the president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. At what point do you begin to be concerned about the rights of the officers involved, and are they potentially infringed when people have access to materials and documents and reports and people themselves?
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the individual case. I mean, even the Supreme Court of the United States has recognized in Graham v. Connor that these questions of reasonableness must be decided on whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in the light of facts and circumstances that confront the actual officer, and that can't be looked at with 20/20 hindsight,
because these scenarios and the issues where force is used are sometimes split-second decisions. And when you have a civilian that, for instance, reads in the newspaper or sees on a police report that the suspect was struck in the back, there's an automatic allegation that the police officer used excessive force, when we all know there are circumstances when a suspect turns at the last second, firing over his shoulder. There are too many reasonable explanations. And what we've seen is that officers are expected to give up their Fourth Amendment rights when they go before civilian review boards, and the Supreme Court says they don't have to do that, and they shouldn't do that, that we should have the same rights. And you have to understand that the union's responsibility is to provide due process. There are a number of cases, especially in arbitration and grievances, where the union decides not to file on behalf of an officer if his actions were outside the scope of his employment. But they also have a duty to provide legal counsel for due process in many of these cases. And, you know, the union's responsibility is to make sure that those officers' rights are protected. You don't lose rights for putting a badge on in this country.
You talked about public perceptions. How much have social media and the ability of everybody to use a cell phone complicated these issues? Chuck Canterbury.
Well, I think day before yesterday, when Fox News reported a shooting in the streets of Baltimore, it went viral on the internet. And before they could get off the air, they realized they had made an egregious error and had to apologize. But Facebook, Twitter, and Snapchat lit up, and hundreds of people were responding to the streets over a shooting that didn't occur. A woman gave a statement. She saw a police shoot him in the back, and there was nobody shot. Suspect dropped a gun, and the gun went off. So I think social media has been the scourge of the of a lot of society, and I think that, unfortunately, more people believe what they read on the internet than what they see in their own eyes.
Are you in favor of body cams?
Yeah, we've never opposed body cams as an organization, but we do believe that there are a lot of civil rights that have to be determined. You know, when we go inside somebody's home, whether or not they want us to film has to be an issue. Whether or not officer has to keep his camera on when he's performing bodily functions. I mean, body cameras are being thrown out there without any rules. And I think that can be just as dangerous as not having them.
Let me go back to Wesley Lowery, our national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for the Washington Post. What's happening politically around the country? The politicians are the ones who ultimately have to make the kinds of decisions that we are talking about to establish or not establish various institutional methods of review and processes and rules.
Well, of course, and I think that was a great point that was just made about body cameras, that they are often thrown out there as this catch-all. Well, we'll just put the cameras on everyone, we'll give them funding for that, and that'll fix these problems. But as police unions have rightfully pointed out, as have a lot of free speech groups and independent groups, they certainly aren't a catch-all. They certainly aren't going to fix everything, because there's no standard for what, when these cameras need to be on or have to be on, what you then do with all this video, how long is the police department required to keep all these videos indefinitely forever. And so there's a lot of questions as we look at the political environment around these issues. You do seem to have a general consensus in support of body cameras across the political spectrum. But as we get into other conversations about other types of reforms, and also just about policing ideology more broadly, and about whether or not the federal government should be spending more money, should be doing more of these reviews, you do start to see some disagreements, you know, along the political spectrum.
Are these disagreements leading to inaction? Are these issues just so difficult that politicians at various levels would rather not deal with them?
I think certainly, because they're very politically charged. You have police unions that are extremely powerful. They represent a lot of people in many of these jurisdictions, and a lot of politicians are very worried about crossing them one way or the other. In the same way, we still have a legacy of the 80s and early 90s during the drug war, at times when crime was spiking, where no one wanted to be branded as soft on crime. And so there was a big push and a big running away from any conversation about policing reform or changing of policing tactics among politicians, because none of them wanted to be seen as soft on crime. We're starting to see that shift back. The pendulum shift a little bit again, where now we have more people who are discussing the ideas of some type of policing reform, some types of policing ideology changing. However, we still have not seen broad action either at the state level or at the federal level. And what is going to be key here is because you have 18,000 police departments in the United States of America, all of which get their funding locally as well as federally, as well at the state level. It's a complicated weave of bureaucracy in terms to make any change, whether that's putting more cops on the streets, whether that's changing policies and changing training. It's remarkably complicated.
Professor McGuire, back to you at American University. Are the social media and the body cams and the new kinds of evidence that we now see before us all the time, some of it coming from amateur sources, also putting pressure not just on the police but also on the politicians?
Absolutely. You know, and social media is bringing with it some great challenges for American policing, for police all over the world. Fortunately, just like, you know, a generation ago, the big deal was to put in place professional public information officers to help police manage their image in the conventional media. Now we're seeing agencies also rising to the challenge and putting in place really effective and very powerful social media strategies so that they can present themselves in the best possible light. And I think that's a very positive reform. Your other callers have pointed out, I think, correctly that body cams are not a panacea. It's very difficult politically to be against them. There's not much of a reason to be against them. But Chuck is right that this technological solution carries with it a lot of baggage. This is going to be very complex, very difficult. It comes with a lot of issues, civil rights issues and privacy issues and these kinds of things. They're essential, I think. I think this is an important reform, but it's not a panacea, because at the end of the day, what really matters is how police behave during their interactions with citizens, how they talk to people and these kinds of issues. And one of the things that we need to be careful about is making sure that we don't treat body cams as a substitute for more substantive reform.
Wesley Lowery, what about the partisan nature of politics in this country? Traditionally, the conservatives and the Republicans have been much more supportive of the police, it would appear to me, than Democrats and liberals have been. Is that beginning to change, particularly given the kind of activity that we've seen over the past few months?
One thing we're seeing is a change in the rhetoric. If we remember back to the anecdotes we were hearing last year, whether when Eric Gardner first happened, when Michael Brown happened, John Crawford in Cincinnati, especially on the right hand of the spectrum, there was a lot of let's wait and see. This kid was a thug. He deserved it. It was coming. Now, as we're seeing this new round of anecdotes here in 2015, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, we are seeing a lot of people on the right, Republicans, conservative pundits, who are starting to say, hey, I support the police. I love the police. But maybe it isn't anti-police to say that some of these things being done in some of these cases are unacceptable. And I think we are seeing a change in the rhetoric here, where now across the political spectrum, people are starting to believe that we've hit a moment, in part due to the new social media pressures and the new cell phone video cameras, where we are now seeing more police interactions. And so therefore, there is more scrutiny of them. And I think that is starting to apply across the spectrum.
Chuck Canterbury, what do you think of that? And do you see support waning or changing?
I think every politician, when they're running for office, is an anti-crime, pro-law enforcement candidate. But the proof is in the pudding. You can look at the last two presidential administrations' funding for law enforcement since the middle of the first Bush 43 term has gone down substantially. And they want to do more for less. And I think that the police unions across the country have been saying that, you know, the first responsibility of government is the safety and security of their citizens. And funding, either from the conservative or liberal side, has just not been there for law enforcement. The crime had gone down since the mid-90s when we had the influx of officers. When there's a lack of fear of crime, politicians' phones don't ring. And when they don't ring, they'd rather spend the money on other things. And that's been a huge issue in the last, I'd say, 10 to 12 years.
You have a lot of members in the National Fraternal Order of Police. What would you say, generally speaking, is their mood now? Are they feeling on the defensive?
Well, put yourself in their position where there are over 13.5 million arrests annually and probably 100 million police contacts annually in the United States. 30 or 40 issues around the country in 4 years, puts a spotlight on them that never shows what they do on a day-in, day-out basis. I mean, there are hundreds of people that are saved by police every year from either their own ability to hurt themselves or hurt others, and I would put that at thousands of people. And so, yeah, there's a lot of police officers that feel that we've lost public support. But then when you turn around and issues in Ohio 2 years ago when Governor Kasich took their bargaining rights away and the citizens overwhelmingly voted to give them back, I think that the citizens traditionally support law enforcement. And we're not opposed to reforms. I would think the police unions have made more reforms possible in this country by forcing contractual issues with management than management's ever done. But the problem with that is only about 43% of law enforcement in this country is unionized. So 57% of them are working without a police contract and working for at-will employment when they can be fired for anything. So, you know, standards are great, but standards need to be across the board. If I'm working in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, or working in New York City, my judicial due process should be the same, and it's not.
Michael Giannacco, very quickly, you worked on police oversight. Do you think the police are getting a bad rep?
You know, I think the police, obviously, what's presented to the public is sometimes a distorted view of all the police citizen activity that goes on every day. That being said, you know, the fact of the matter is Americans have wanted to believe in their police departments and believe in their police officers. And I think that, you know, the just like any other group of individuals, police are humans, and you're going to have people that are been hired that should not have been hired on this function. And that's what's coming out, I think.
All right, Michael Giannacco, once again, former federal prosecutor, now focusing on police misconduct and prosecutions and oversight as well. Chuck Canterbury, again, president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. Wesley Lowry with the Washington Post. Ed McGuire, professor of criminology at American University. Upcoming pamphlet, Policing Protests, Lessons from the Occupy Movement and Beyond, a guidebook for police. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Britain has a parliamentary system, but for many decades it's been a two-party affair. Well, tomorrow's election could make a historic difference in that. We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Well, we're only back with today's talking point. In Britain, it's not just the Conservative and Labour parties anymore. There are challengers in tomorrow's election from both the left and the right. And the outcome, of course, under those circumstances, is unpredictable. Griff Whitty is London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here, Juan.
So we've got Labour, we've got the Conservatives, we've got the Scottish National Party, the UK Independence Party called UKIP, and we've got the Green Party. And they all have some really interesting characters in charge of them.
They do, and they've become some of the biggest names in British politics. Of course, the leaders of the two main parties are David Cameron, the Prime Minister, who's the Conservative Party leader, and Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, who's challenging Cameron. One of those two men will be Prime Minister after this election. But it's Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party, Nigel Farage, the leader of the UK Independence Party, who are in many ways even more so than the main leaders. They're really steering the debate in Britain these days. They're really the ones who are pushing the leaders of the main parties and setting the agenda. And they actually could be in real positions of control and leverage after the election.
So whoever becomes prime minister is going to have a coalition in order to govern.
That's right. For the longest time, Britain was a system in which one party won the election and that party got to govern for several years and until the next election. And really, what we saw last time in 2010 was that neither party won, and the Conservative Party had to form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. This time, it could be much more complicated than that. It's possible that there won't be two parties that are strong enough together to form a coalition and form a government. It may be three parties. It may be four parties. So it's a real fragmentation of the electorate, and it's going to make Britain a much harder place to govern.
Now, Scottish independence was rejected very decisively very recently, just a few months ago. What does the Scottish National Party want now?
Well, what they say is they want more rights, more money, more powers for Scotland. And they say that in order to do that, they need representation in Westminster, which is the meaning Parliament. For the longest time, Scotland was completely dominated by the Labour Party. For decades and decades, Scotland has just sent Labour members of Parliament, or elected Labour members of Parliament. But what we're seeing this year is just an incredible sea change, where Labour is being completely decimated in Scotland, and the Scottish Nationalist Party seems like it's going to dominate the vote there.
Now, what about the UK Independence Party? Where are they coming from? What do they want?
The UK Independence Party wants to take Britain out of the European Union, and their message has been very strongly anti-immigration. They feel that there are far too many immigrants coming to this country, and they believe that exiting the EU is the best way to reduce the immigration levels. They're going to do quite well in the election tomorrow. They're going to get about 12% of the vote, most likely, but because of the way Britain's political system is structured, they're only going to get a very small handful of seats in Parliament. So even though their voice is loud in the campaign, it's likely that they're not going to have that large a role in the next Parliament.
Well, now tell us about the best known of the candidates here in this country, at least, David Cameron, who's the current Prime Minister, and Ed Miliband.
Well, Cameron was not expecting a race that was this close. Right now, Cameron and Miliband are essentially tied. They're each getting about a third of the vote. Months and months ago, before the campaign really kicked off, the assumption was that Cameron was going to pull way ahead. The economy here is recovering. Cameron is personally much more popular than Miliband, but it's been an incredibly tight race. And at this point, it's even money as far as whether Cameron or Miliband will emerge from this contest as prime minister. Miliband has performed a lot better than many people thought he would under the glare of a national campaign.
I've heard him called crudely, perhaps, kind of weird.
He has that reputation, and that was the main hurdle that he had to overcome in this campaign. When you look at him, when you watch him speak, he's not someone who instantly jumps out to a lot of people as prime ministerial material. But he performed much better than expected in debates going against David Cameron. And as the campaign wore on, as he has been able to speak to voters directly rather than through the filter of the media in a lot of cases, he's come out better than people thought he would. And he's making the point that even though the economy is healing, that the gap between rich and poor has grown much wider. And that's really what he's campaigning on.
Let's just hear a bit about what this of what this campaign sounds like. There was a question time on the BBC, and a voter was able to ask a question last week. It was directed to Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, it was about the government under the previous Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
Can you stand there and say you didn't overspend and end up bankrupting this country? That is absolutely ludicrous. You're frankly just lying.
And that was Ed Miliband?
So that was someone asking a question of Ed Miliband, and that question was fairly typical of the questions that we heard from voters in that debate. Basically, the voters were given free rein to just throw bricks at the candidates, and that's exactly what they did. There's a real sour mood about politics in this country, and when voters were given the chance to ask the candidates questions, they hit them pretty hard.
Why a sour mood? Once again, you said David Cameron expected that things were going to be fine. The economy's been picking up a bit. What's been happening to turn people off?
I think it's still the overhang of a few things. Number one, the global financial crisis, which obviously hit this country very hard. I think it's the legacy of the Iraq War as well. People feel a real disenchantment with the establishment. They feel that their leaders have not served them well. And so both Labour and the Conservative Party are really suffering from the perception that politicians just don't have people's interests at heart, that they lie, that they cheat, that they steal, and that the country deserves better than the leaders they're getting.
We heard Miliband accused of being a part of a party that is ludicrous and, frankly, just lying. He's not even in charge at the moment. Did Cameron get the same kind of questions?
He did. He was hit very hard by voters who said that he's been responsible for the record number of Britons on food stamps or on needing to go to food banks to eat. He was hit hard on the austerity measures that have been enacted since he came to power. So it was equal opportunity. Both candidates taking some real blows in that debate.
We are already getting ready to campaign here in this country for an election that won't occur until November of next year. How long have they been campaigning in Britain for an election that's going to occur tomorrow?
The campaign has been 6 weeks, which Brits will tell you is absolutely interminable. And I just laugh when they say that. Because, of course, Americans know what an interminable campaign looks like, and 6 weeks is not that. But the sense is that 6 weeks is more than enough time to decide and for campaigns to get their message out. And Britain actually has a higher rate of voter participation than the United States does, in spite of the fact that it's a much more shorter campaign and it's a campaign that involves no television advertisement.
So does it appear that it's possible that Britain will leave the EU? Is that one of the options that people are going to have to consider as they go to the polls?
It certainly is. If Cameron is reelected, he's promised a referendum on European Union membership by 2017. So if Cameron pulls out this election, if he wins this election and gets another term as prime minister, will almost instantly go from a discussion of who should leave Britain to whether Britain should leave the EU.
So once again, that immigration issue comes up, very important, obviously, to Britain as it is to other European countries. Well, Griff Whitty, thanks a lot for giving us the background on an election that's going to occur tomorrow. It's going to be very interesting to see how it comes out.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Great to talk with you. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.